In our last episode, we spent time in Danebury, a giant hill fort just north of Southampton. We discovered a world of small-time communities just about managing off the produce of the land. Their relationships with their neighbours were rarely positive. Trade was seemingly non-existent. Instead, raids were common, either to steal goods or to exact revenge for other people trying to steal. This fragmentary, violent world was held together by an equally disparate and diverse priest class, who may be the ancestors of the Druids who terrified Roman soldiers in the 1st century AD. Today we visit West Wang Slack in East Yorkshire, a place with an amusing name and, according to my mother, excellent fish and chips. In this dry river valley, we will see many of the same themes, a violent world of many different regions, each one self-sufficient and with their own distinct culture. We'll also learn more about the nature of that violence. You see, at West Wang Slack, some other burials are chariot burials. These rich tombs don't just hint at the nature of warfare in the Iron Age. They also suggest the development of a clear warrior hierarchy, and perhaps the origins of the tribal chiefdoms which the Romans encountered and gave birth to British legends like Boudicca. We're starting to get truly Celtic today. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. East Yorkshire in the Iron Age wasn't home to sleepy villages, seaside resorts, and fishing towns like today. Instead, it was home to a distinct culture protected by geography. The River Humber created an impenetrable moat to the south, the ocean was to the east, and the bleak North York Moors to the north. The only land route connecting this place to the rest of the country was to the west, the Vale of York, a rich, flat land. The people who lived in this verdant, fertile and gently rolling landscape are known as the Arras culture. The name got given to them in the 20th century by Gordon Child. We've met Professor Child before. He is famous for two things. The first is excavating Scarab Brae in Orkney. That's how we met him. However, his most important contributions to archaeology weren't his excavations, but his theory. Child was a cultural historian, an approach to archaeology we've justifiably criticised before. As a reminder, cultural historians see the past as a long list of different people, each replacing the next by murder, invasion, or immigration. Child was an out-and-out cultural historian. He was also a Marxist, a communist, working in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. It's a good thing he lived in 20th century Britain. If he'd been American, McCarthy would have had his guts for garters. Gordon Child combined his cultural historian lens with his Marxist politics and used that to make several important contributions to archaeological thinking. He saw prehistory as a series of internationalist revolutions. He coined terms like the Neolithic Revolution and the Urban Revolution, concepts we still use today. He was also one of the first archaeologists to see Britain not as an isolated island, but as part of the broader trends throughout Europe. This is how he came across the Arras culture. In the late 19th century, a cemetery of 100 square barrows had been discovered beneath Arras Farm in East Yorkshire. Four of those tombs contained chariot burials. Many of the grave goods reminded Child of the material culture of the Iron Age people of the Paris region, an area that fell under the umbrella of Latin culture, which is archaeological speak for Celtic or Gaulish. Gordon Child decided that because this was a unique culture to Britain, it deserved its own term, and thus it was called the Arras culture after the first site of discovery. That is a pretty typical naming convention in archaeology. It's the same logic that applies to the name of the species Homo neanderthalensis, which literally means man from the Neander Valley, where the first Neanderthal skull was found. At any rate, Gordon didn't just name the culture. He also made some assertions about its origins. Essentially, he saw these people as immigrants from the Paris region. He saw them as the link between the Bronze Age natives and the later Parisii tribe described by Ptolemy in 150 CE. And you know what? He was right. Well, mostly. The Arras culture is a distinct material culture, unique to Britain and similar to that of the Iron Age people who lived in the Paris Basin. It's a neat story. There was a Parisii tribe in Iron Age Gaul, which gave the modern-day city of Paris its name. There was also a tribe called the Parisii in East Yorkshire during the early Romano-British period. In the same region, right before the Romans started writing about them in detail, there was a culture which is similar in both East Yorkshire and northern France. However, even if these people did originally come from the continent, it was probably a short-lived period of migration. These weren't an offshoot of a singular people, a Gallic colony in the Yorkshire Hills. This was really, truly a British culture. Perhaps it was one which began life as a small group of hardy migrants, but they quickly fell in love with their new home. Of course they did. It was Yorkshire.
Yorkshire! Yorkshire!
Soon after their arrival, they cut off and forgot their continental roots. They stopped importing jewellery and began making their own. They stopped sailing their oceans. They even stopped eating fish. They started living off the land. They turned the continental style of metalworking they brought with them into something that was more of their own. And they also began burying their dead. They put them in square barrows, vast cemeteries of hundreds of burials beneath these oddly shaped mounds. In that deeply personal act, we see vestiges of their continental origins. Beneath the tombs of some of their greatest warriors, they buried them with the most glorious objects of war, their chariots. These cemeteries were near their villages, which they built in the dry chalk and gravel valleys that crisscross East Yorkshire. The modern Yorkshire folk, who aren't really Celtic and are descended instead from Anglo-Saxons and Scandinavians, give these valleys a suitably Saxon name. They call them slacks. In one of those slacks, named after the village of Wetwang, I don't want to know what that word really means, is a giant cemetery, nearly 500 burials and three of those chariot burials. And that's our site for today, Wetwang Slack. Let's talk about what's found there. As we said, Wetwang Slack is a dried-up river valley, now filled with gravel. The square barrows that are so distinctive of this culture are really hard to see. They've all been ploughed away. Yorkshire is full of good farmland, you see. Instead, to find these barrows, you have to keep your eyes peeled for crop marks appearing in aerial and satellite photography. And even then, they don't always show up. That was the case at Wetwang. No one knew there was a cemetery there, and so the area was marked for gravel extraction. This is the same reason the site of Boxgrove was discovered way back in episode 1. Full marks to me for narrative consistency, I think. In Britain, when a JCB hits human bones, two things happen. First, the police are called. If the coppers don't think the bones are suggestive of anything sinister, they move on. Then you have to call in the archaeologists. I am so tempted to jump on my soapbox here. That law that archaeologists get a chance to dig when important things are found has led to some of the most incredible archaeology being discovered all across this country. It's a marvellous law, almost constantly under threat because of lobbying by many construction and mining companies who are far richer and savvier than your average archaeologist. However, I will restrain myself. You're not here for politics, you're here for dead bodies. And anyway, I don't want to shoot myself in the foot. Might want a job as an archaeologist for one of those construction or mining companies in the future. At Wetwang Slack, just as the gravel extraction was beginning, they hit upon dead bodies. The archaeologists were called and they started digging and digging and digging. They kept digging and digging and digging. They stripped half an acre of soil and revealed one of the largest Iron Age cemeteries in the country. The cemetery was clustered between two ancient trackways, ancient even in the Iron Age. Aris culture cemeteries tend to respect field boundaries that date back to the Bronze Age, suggesting that there was continuity between this culture and the society preceding them. The burials date between 2400 and 2200 years ago, right to the very end of the Middle Iron Age period. Most of the burials are given their own enclosure. This was a square ditch, presumably with the earth piled into the centre. This would have created the so-called square barrows, although we don't know exactly how they would have looked. No square barrow survived to the modern days. Every burial is an inhumation, a full human body placed in the graves, usually aligned with the head facing north. The bodies lie on the left-hand side, so their face looks east to the rising sun, and they're crouched up, like they're curling themselves tight beneath a cosy quilt. Sometimes they're buried in proper graves, potentially buried in wooden coffins or at least wood-lined grave pits. Other times they're buried in shallow scrapes in the earth. There has been a suggestion that one of the reasons for there being so few Iron Age burials is that many people were simply laid in shrouds on the ground. If so, the differing depths of graves might be suggesting of different levels of status. The poor and lonely are abandoned to the skies, whilst the richest are preserved in deep beds surrounded by fine goods. This supports a general assumption in that every person who lived in these Iron Age villages was buried for around 7 generations. The village is assumed to have averaged around 100 souls, so you'd expect to see somewhere in the realm of 700 people. If the poorest and loneliest of villagers were left exposed, that would explain the gap of 200 or so burials. Or perhaps we didn't get the entire cemetery, and they're still waiting to be discovered beneath Wet Wang soil. I'll never get bored of saying that site's name. Wet Wang. The site and its cemetery developed over time. Initially, it was just a settlement, which makes sense. You kind of need living people before you get dead folk. The other way around is some weird necromancy stuff that is not for this sort of podcast. Quite rapidly, this settlement moved up the valley. We know this because the enclosure of the first settlement was used as the enclosure ditch for the cemetery. These initial burials made the most of the space. Whilst the actual graves were pretty sparse and light on grave goods, they did have very large ditches and barrows atop them. The settlement itself developed between two roads and over time became more and more of a linear village along one of those roads. The buildings of this village were all pretty much the same as those at Danebury. There were a lot of roundhouses, all of similar size. There were many grain pits and those same four-post structures we interpreted as excarnation platforms last episode. There are a few things to unpack here, to compare and contrast with Danebury in our last episode. Let's begin with the roundhouses. At both Danebury and Wet Wang, indeed all across the country, the only buildings we find regularly are roundhouses and four-post structures. The roundhouses are consistently the same size. The name might fool you, roundhouses. You see, initially the assumption, my assumption, was, oh, we found a lot of houses, well, a lot of places for people to live. If you think a bit deeper, though, maybe you realise that means pottery making or metallurgy must have taken place outside. But then you run into a problem of Britain's climate. I wrote this part of the script in February, having just got back from my stag do in Barcelona. In Catalonia, the sun was shining, the sky was blue, the temperature comfortable, and the sun set at 7 o'clock. Wall-to-wall sun for 5 days. Speaking to the waiters and barmaids in my broken Spanish and their excellent English, they assured me that the weather was not always that good. Sometimes it was even cloudy. On mainland Europe, in Spain and Italy, you can be outside on most days for 10 months of the year, even more. Especially if you're doing something that involves a lot of fire, like metalworking or pottery making, you want to be outside. I came home from Barcelona and the day of my return was a grey, miserable one. It was cold and windy and wet. In the north of England, it was snowing. The sky was dark, and the sun set at around 5 o'clock. In London, the day was a full 3 hours shorter than in Barcelona. That's excellent weather for spending the day in a pub, but terrible if you have to work outside. Britain's climate in the Iron Age was broadly similar to that of today. What that means is that during the 3 months of the year when there is little point tending to your fields, going outside is pretty terrible. Getting a fire lit outside on a British day in February is an unenviable task. Keeping that fire going, nigh on impossible. Like the Brits of today, the Brits of the Iron Age probably would have done their best to hunker down when the weather was, well, British. So roundhouses can't just have been used for housing. Sure enough, from certain roundhouses we have evidence of much larger fires and higher concentrations of iron in the soil. Around these roundhouses are shallow pits with heavy evidence of burning, and near those particular roundhouses was a slight increase in the number of pottery sherds discovered. Roundhouses, then, is a misleading term. They were round buildings, some used for housing and some used for industry. Still others might have been used for religious purposes, a little like a less magical version of the Druid's Hut in Asterix and Obelisk. In that way, these round buildings were analogous with the tower blocks of today. Archaeologically speaking, there's little difference between an office block and an apartment block, save for the rubbish each one produces. The second notable type of structure at Wet Wang Slack settlement were the four-post structures. Archaeologically, these are near identical to the platforms we discussed at Danebury. There, we interpreted those as potential platforms for excarnation, pushing the bodies of the dead high into the sky to be given back to Mother Nature. At Wet Wang, the consensus is that these were used for storage. This is a point that highlights the hyper-regionality of the Iron Age. At Wet Wang, we have a burial tradition, not an excarnation tradition. It is probable, based on the number of bodies, that everyone was buried inhumated in one form or another. At Danebury, only a minority of the dead were buried. Also, at Wet Wang, whilst there are grain pits, they are smaller and less numerous than those at Danebury. This forces us to interpret two identical-looking structures, archaeologically speaking, in very different ways. The only way for us to make sense of this is to assume at Wet Wang and Danebury, there are two very different societies. They have different burial traditions and different storage methodologies. This suggests they were very different culturally, whilst being similar technologically and economically. This collection of round buildings, grain pits, and storage platforms moved around over time throughout the landscape. The cemetery stayed the same. When space got tight, all barrows were cut into by newer enclosures. Early on in the cemetery's existence, as we mentioned, they make the most of the space. They have larger enclosures, which have been interpreted to mean bigger barrows. Whilst the burial enclosures, the barrow ditches, are of similar size, the slight difference in size might suggest that the more respected individuals within the society were given larger mounds. The enclosures are so large that even a slight increase in the size of the enclosure would have significantly increased the volume of earth that made it up in the mound. That's the only evidence, though, that we have of social difference in the early society. There are few, if any, grave goods during this period. And these burials existed around 2,400 to 2,250 years ago, a similar time to when Danebury began to exist, the early Iron Age. In the latter half of Wet Wang's existence, from 2,250 to 2,100 years ago, the cemetery became more cramped. The burial mounds got smaller, but the graves got deeper and the burials themselves started to get richer. 21.5% of the burials at Wet Wang contain grave goods. Truly stupendous burials are forever rare, with most burials having a single brooch or a joint of meat in them. All grave good types, jewellery, food, pottery, weaponry, they become more common as time moves forward. It might be that as space became restricted, even putting a pig leg into the burial or a spear was enough to mark the person out as special. However, sometimes the burials are stupendous. At Wet Wang, there are three chariot burials. Two of these people, indeed almost all of the chariot burials found in Yorkshire, belong to men. However, one did belong to a woman. In these burials, first the wheels, the central shaft, and the harness of the chariot were placed in the grave. Then the dead person was placed atop those parts of the chariot. Usually they were kitted for war with armour or weaponry. Then we believe the actual cart of the chariot, which has rotted away now, was placed atop them before the barrow was built. These chariots aren't plain things. Their horse bridles are brightly decorated, and the bodies placed in the burials would have been dressed beautifully. Sometimes there is evidence of feasting with those same chariot burials. All of which is great, but as Austin Powers would say, whoop-de-doo, Basil, what does it all mean? Well, that's what we'll find out next. Wet Wang Slack reinforces many of the things which we already know about from Danebury. It reminds us of the diversity of cultures, the limited connections to the wider world, and the simple plain material culture that these people had. But more than anything else, the chariot burials of Wet Wang Slack reinforces the image of a world of violence, but a violence which is built around small, fast raids. The Britons, like many Celtic people, preferred to fight in small groups. Even when vast numbers of Gauls fought against the Romans, they fought as individuals in small groups rather than the repetitive machine-like brutality of the Romans. That's because warfare for them wasn't about conquest for the fatherland. It was about glory, wealth, and prestige for the individual. The burials at Wet Wang Slack tell us something about the nature of that warfare. We don't see many burials of heavily armoured and richly decorated warriors. Apart from one notable armoured exception, most of the time, if someone is buried with a weapon, it is a spear or, very rarely, a sword. This suggests that warfare was done by lightly armoured people fighting with simple weaponry. It was about prowess and bravery. This is reinforced by the chariots. Although one of the chariot burials in East Yorkshire contained a man dressed in mail, most don't, and reconstructions suggest these chariots were very light vehicles. They allowed you to move quickly across the landscape, but they weren't the war chariots we see in films like Gladiator. Heavy platforms for shooting missiles, decked out with scythes on the wheels to bring butchery to your foe. No. The archaeology, history and experiments suggest that the Britons would leap from the chariots to fight, before retreating back to them and fleeing to safety if they got outnumbered. They were for the tactical deployment of a well-trained and well-armed elite. They would also raise the greatest warriors above the ground, allowing their comrades to see them. All of which reminds us again that the raids were small, quick attacks designed to steal food, visit retribution, and also to gain glory. Another way that Wet Wang reinforces Danebury is the cultural variety we see in Iron Age Britain. The Aris culture don't use hill forts, and the Danebury folk didn't bury their dead in square barrows. The culture around Danebury was forever incredibly insular. Whereas there are hints that early on in Wet Wang's existence, the Aris culture was connected to people on the continents. The evidence for this is the similarities of the early brochework and the chariot burial tradition. There are similarities, though. Both Danebury and Wet Wang developed substantially over time. The people who lived in the latter periods of both regions were not the same society as that one which had existed a few hundred years before. Both populations had grown, cultural identifiers had become more clear. And at Wet Wang at least, there is the suggestion of the development of a warrior elite. That's why I chose to speak about Wet Wang today. We're talking about Wet Wang Slack not just because it has a funny name, or because it is in Yorkshire, or because chariot burials are objectively really cool. These are obvious factors, of course. But Wet Wang Slack contributes to this season's narrative because we begin to see the development of a hierarchy based on wealth, prestige, and family. Something which has been near impossible to identify for certain in any of our previous episodes. How do we spot hierarchy in the archaeological record? The gold standard is conspicuous consumption. Essentially, that means bragging. A small number of people wasting resources on non-productive activities in a way that the rest of the population can't. We all know someone who, having made a bit of cash, tries to show how much better they are by buying a flashy car or putting on a load of horrible but impressive jewellery or bragging about their expensive holidays. It's a way to say, I am more important than you, without actually saying those words. Indeed, in many cultures, people don't even realise that is what they are doing. It's just what you do when you reach a certain stage in your life or career. For example, weddings. Our society does pressure people, especially to get married, and that same society pressures you to have a big, expensive wedding because you deserve it. The hidden implication is that if you don't have a big and expensive wedding, you're not as worthy as the other people. It doesn't make any logical sense, of course, but then again, humans don't make logical sense when it comes to most things. At Wet Wang Slack, we have clear evidence that some people were treated differently to others in a flashy, over-the-top way. Some people were buried with weapons when others weren't. Some women wore fancy brooches, others weren't. And of course, three people, 0.6% of all the burials, were buried under chariots with fancy decoration. What's happening here? Well, it's time for another bit of theory. How does power develop? In the Iron Age, hierarchy begins with warfare. Over the last couple of episodes, we've seen a pretty convincing image that during this period, warfare was common, small-scale, and, for want of a better word, heroic. Victory came about because of talented individuals fighting in small groups. This is a trend we see in sport today. The smaller the team, the bigger the impact an individual can have on a team. Basketball, with teams of five, relies more on individual genius than football with teams of 11, and football is in turn affected by a single brilliant individual more than rugby union with a team of 15. In the same way, then, that Michael Jordan becomes richer and more famous than Jonolomu, the warriors who fought in these small-scale Iron Age bands became comparatively richer and more famous than, say, a really good Roman legionary. That successful warrior is involved in and survives more raids and gains wealth in whatever form it took during the Iron Age. He might be given more food than others, or better weapons. He might be given more land, or perhaps just more influence in the community's decision-making. Wealth and prestige are powerful tools. If that great warrior has the brains to equal his brawn, he will then use that wealth and prestige to benefit not just himself, but also those whom he cares for. In most societies, this means the great warrior's supporters and family. Either the great warrior will physically give wealth to those around him, or that warrior will use his prestige to ensure those around him have similarly influential positions without having to rely on their own ability. That said, those followers might still have to justify their position by talent on the battlefield. However, they don't need to be a great, great warrior, just good enough not to embarrass themselves. We all recognise this, right? We've all met the child of a successful parent who lands an excellent job and becomes more successful than the less privileged kids. The child of success is probably very capable, but their capabilities are magnified by the wealth and prestige of their successful parent. We actually see this at Wet Wang, and it reinforces a concept we introduced at Danebury. When discussing Danebury, I argued that women were as equally important as men in the Iron Age, but in a different sphere. Well, at Wet Wang we have a woman buried beneath a chariot with all the panoply of war. I interpret this as a bit of a Boudicca figure. To recap, Boudicca was the wife of a client king of Rome. That client king left his kingdom to his wife. However, for complicated reasons, the Romans disagreed and took the kingdom off of Boudicca, raping her and her daughters whilst they were doing so. Boudicca responded to this crime by raising an army and rebelling, which he did very successfully. What's interesting is that the Britons, the Celts, completely accepted the wife of a king, not just becoming their leader, but also a warrior. So long as she could fight, the Britons seemed quite happy to follow her. This is in stark contrast to the Romans, who quite bluntly hated the idea of a woman ruler. There isn't evidence of women gaining status, but there is evidence of women inheriting status, and so long as they didn't do anything to undermine that prestige, society accepted their control. I think that's what the female chariot burial represented. Great warriors were gaining greater status and then handing it off to their family. Those family members, regardless of their gender, were then using, maintaining, and potentially growing that status. This leads to the final stage. To steal from ex-president Zuma, it can be considered state capture. This new elite uses their wealth and prestige to capture the levers of power, whether those are economic, political, cultural, or even religious. They hold those levers of power close to themselves and use them to create a class apart from the rest. Due to those greater resources, that separate class became healthier, stronger, better educated, and better equipped. They began to look different and act differently too. Over time, people forget that at one time, everyone was equal, and the lower classes accept the ruling classes as a natural way of things. Power has ossified, as has a class structure. It's at this point you can begin to describe society as a chiefdom. There is a chiefly class who use violence and economic control to rule. I think we're seeing this with the advent of chariot burials. I also think this is a trend that happens in different ways and at different times across much of Britain. This development of hierarchy, tribes and chiefdoms is, for me at least, one of the defining differences between the Middle and Late Iron Age. For example, it's at the time around that of the chariot burials that hill forts like Danebury begin to be abandoned. They'll be inhabited again when the Romans invade, but during these slightly less turbulent times, people left them in favour of oppida. Oppida are smaller hilltop settlements, but they're much richer than hill forts. They sit at the centre of much larger areas, have great evidence of trade and control, and if you want to hear more about them, I'll be releasing a special episode for the patrons. For all the change we see at Wet Wang Slack, for all its cultural uniqueness, the site also reminds us of some of the core trends we see not just in the Iron Age, but throughout our journey through British prehistory. The more things change in British prehistory, the more some things stay the same. Wet Wang Slack Cemetery exists in the bounds of an old settlement. No matter how big or distant the new settlements became, the cemetery forever respected the bounds of that original place. The respective place is the same respective place we see with the Red Lady of Pavland, Cheddar Man, Amesbury Archer, Clad Helen, and it all speaks to the same desire to connect with the people who came before these people. Ancestor worship. There is also an obsession with the importance of place. Rather than expand, the people of Wet Wang Slack would rather make the barrows smaller and more cramped together rather than disrespect the boundaries of the cemetery. Again, reminding us of another key theme throughout prehistory, the importance of place. Finally, there's another connection with Danebury. The bones of children are again treated differently at Wetwang Slack to the rest of the burials. This tells us something interesting about society in Middle and Early Iron Age that fits with the picture we've been painting. Status and value to society in the Iron Age was earned, not given. Children essentially weren't considered people, they were sub-people, not yet part of the community. That's understandable. Agricultural communities, especially ones which had extremely limited diets like those of Iron Age Britain, would have had extraordinarily high rates of child mortality. It's a way to protect yourself, not to grow too close to something you know might disappear. Which isn't to say these children weren't loved. We saw how many babies were buried with tenderness and care at Danebury, suggesting there were some ways for parents to mourn the loss of a child. However, you didn't get full burial rights until you were a full member of society. Mourning children was a private thing, whereas mourning an adult was public, mirroring nicely the private-public dichotomy we've noted in Iron Age gender relationships. Iron Age society then is complex and fascinating. It's a world in which nature and the brutal realities of life were laid bare. In the early and middle Iron Ages, society was more insular than it had been during the Bronze Age. You weren't able to rely on your neighbours in the same way. This meant the language of diplomacy became more about war and religion. Today, we spent a long time looking at how that small-scale but systemic violence eventually began to change society. At Wetwang, we're beginning to see more and more social differences. Some people brought towards themselves greater prestige and greater wealth, and used that to give themselves greater comfort and greater influence. So, going into our last episode of the season, we understand the economy of the British Iron Age. We understand the politics and the checkerboard of cultures present on this relatively small landmass. We've begun to explore the religion of the British Iron Age too. Throughout this season, we've seen cannibalism, mummification, headhunting, individual graves, and mass tombs. There is one last thing to discuss though, the final piece in our discussion of Iron Age religion. Human sacrifice. To understand that macabre oddity, we need to go to northwest England, back to soggy peat bogs. We're going to meet Lindo Man, a bog body. He was murdered in a ritualistic way. His killers? Well, they were probably druids. Let's end this thing on a dark and disturbing high. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones.